listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
We are live here. Anyone can always join us live on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. Just go look up the feed. Father Tim Grumbach's in studio with us.
Always a joy to be back.
And we have a lot to talk about from China and their new social credit policy or Big Brother watch out. I mean, I'm not even kidding. What's happening in China is just sick. And we've been mentioning over the years little bits of even just the persecution of the church in China.
Right,
and
right.
How people, I mean, truly, even though there's this agreement with the Vatican, many priests, religious, are underground still.
Yeah, we're watching the world fall apart and forget who the human person is.
Yeah. It's scary, and China's a real testament to what's happening. And we see places like Ireland where, for the first time in world history, people, not a government, not a judicial system, not a Supreme Court, but people in Ireland voted than not to legalize abortion. And now we're seeing how medical professionals are responding to this in meetings as they're being told they're going to be forced to perform abortions. So we're going to come to that later on, like Father Tim was mentioning on the live feed before we started, because you can hear behind the scenes content in between segments as well. There are some tough topics today. We're going to be talking about the sex abuse scandal in the church. We'll be talking about Virginia high school teacher who was fired. Why was he fired? What's going on there? And we're also going to be talking a little bit lighter. Why do women, this was a study that came out. I'm serious here. You guys, this should concern you. Why is it that we're doing studies to find that women sleep better with their dogs next to them than people? This is a big deal, though. I mean, for real. So just stay tuned because we need to talk about this.
Because dogs give unconditional love, right?
Oh, spoiler alert. Yeah, but it's true, right? We don't want to say too much. But we are spending a good chunk of time to talk about that because I think it's a real good learning lesson for
each of us. We will tie it in with the rest of this. It's real.
It is a real issue. So as always, lots of love, lots of laughter, and lots of truth here on Trending. So stay with us. Father Tim Grumbach is the associate pastor at St. Augustine Parish, and he is a regular here of Trending. We love him, and we really appreciate you always being ready to talk about these tough issues.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to be part of. I learn a lot here, too.
Awesome. Thank you. Father Tim, I'm not kidding. I was in tears. So this is kind of how it came about. I talk a lot about what's happening in China. As in light of the Me Too movement, in light of the feminist movement, I think few things make me more angry than the ignorance of the feminist and Me Too movement, their ignorance of what's happening in China. Mm-hmm. I just kind of want to yell at them anytime I hear them start going off about abortion or women's rights when they're ignoring some of the women who are suffering the most in our world right now.
Yeah, and it's not just human rights issues that we're worried about right now as a church in China. We're worried about the church itself. And just watching over the last few months, last couple of years, as that situation continues to grow, and I can't admit to be any kind of expert about what's happening there politically or you know, with the church, but just to hear the witnesses of the martyrs yeah. that are over there, those who are being persecuted for being a part of the Catholic Church, and you know some major questions about how the church is handling that situation over there right now. So we're looking at it from a human rights point of view, from an ecclesial point of view. There's a lot for us to be worried about, but trusting that the Holy Spirit is going to be in charge of that.
And I'm actually going to pose this next topic. I'm going to ask you to do something about this. And especially those who are having children, have the ability to have children. This is really weighing on my heart. And as I've been praying about it, you guys, I really think that this is something we can do something about, even if just creating awareness. But many of you know that China has held a one-child policy for many years now. They quote-unquote called it a two-child policy, and they were thinking about getting rid of the one-child policy, but they're not. The bottom line is it's still a one-child policy. If the government gives you permission to have a second child, you can have a second child, but that's only if the government gives you permission and only if you come from a household where only one child existed. And if you violate this, the fines on the family members is so astronomical. I mean, up to 10 times your annual salary. And those children that are born have no right to marriage, medical, healthcare, education, you name it. It's a real travesty. But here's one that actually upsets me just as much, if not even more, than forced abortion and sterilization. It's the fact that children, once they turn 14, because many are placed in an adoption home, right? Many of these children, because their parents aren't allowed to raise them if they violate what the government has had to say about you having children. Many of these children, Father Tim, are being placed in orphanages. They're being sold on the black market. But a lot of children are going to orphanages. And in China, once you are 14 years old, that's kind of like the legal status of an 18-year-old here in the United States. And a friend of mine who was adopted from China was sharing that her sister was also adopted from China. And that, yeah, my sister was adopted from China because she was going to be on the streets within a couple weeks. And because she's 14, I had no idea that if you turn 14 years old and you're in an orphanage, you are put out on the streets in China. What kind of nation does that to their children? And here's the deal. We can do something about this. If you have the ability to, I think that we need to reach out and say, you know what, that's enough, China. We're going to accept these children. We're going to start adopting these children into our homes. Because it's urgent that these children, as soon as they turn 13 years old, are adopted.
Yeah, and a part of our culture will look at that and say, well, that's too many children. I mean, that's the mindset of the Chinese government from the first place, is that there's too many children and they adopted these policies. And then you have the children who are up for adoption, and you know they hit this age of 14 years old, and it looks like, you know, even when they're 13 years old, you know, you have to get on that because of the situation of paperwork and whatnot. Otherwise, this child will either be, you know, sent back out onto the streets, or they'll be kept in the orphanage to be working. Mm-hmm. And rather than, you know, having an experience of family.
It's an indentured servant type of position at that point, though.
Right. And we're seeing it in our own culture, too, what happens when family begins to fall apart.
Yeah.
And to know that there's this, you know, generation of young people there at the age of 14, that they're, once they turn 14, they're going to lose this opportunity for a stable family. And we recognize family as this cornerstone for society. And when they don't have that opportunity in a country that's still continuing to boom in population, then we're going to have a complete generation of young people who do not have an experience of family. And therefore, you know, what kind of society is going to be, you know, we get so focused on what's happening in front of us right here and now that we're not willing to or able to look at what's going to be happening, you know, in 14 years when these young people have grown into adults and they've not had that experience of family, that they're the ones who are going to be populating the earth. They're the ones who are going to be our artists, our politicians, our doctors, or whatever it is that they're able to accomplish in life. And that, you know, they're going to say, well, look what I did. I didn't have a family. Or it's just going to go down the drain because they didn't have a family.
Yeah. I mean, these are people who they have no lasting relationships. Mm-hmm. They have no religion, because we just started by mentioning religion. Religious persecution is so real in China. And yet we're not talking about it. Like, women, wake up. When you start hearing people talk about whether or not abortion should be legal or further access in California and the United States, no, point to China, where women are being forced to abort and are committing suicide at a rate of 500 women per day. The only place in the world where more women are committing suicide than men. And that's because of a lost motherhood, because they know their children are being put on the streets. Like, I hear this, you guys, and we can do something about this. Maybe you yourself can adopt a child. Because here's the deal. We're learning that these children are actually very well behaved, and in fact, docile children. Not that this is the reason you should adopt them, but they have no behavioral issues, no disabilities. But their one true anguish is that they are going to be leaving a system that has ripped them from their families, that has left them abandoned, and now set them on the streets at 14 years of age. And so I just want to really encourage you, look into being aware of what's happening in China, and letting other people know, maybe some older parents who can adopt children. Head over to gwca.org. It's Great Wall China Adoption, and many other organizations. I'll tweet links out as well. And pray over this. And maybe you can give this information to someone else who has the means to adopt a child.
And it's so great to have this practical solution, something that we can actually do, you know, prayers and actions, right? To have something in front of us that we can actually do to help the situation. But we can't forget that, you know, especially for the church, church in China that we have a responsibility to be praying and sacrificing and fasting for that church, because look at what they're going through. They are enduring persecution and martyrdom, and this isn't something from the past. This is something that they're facing right now, and we have a responsibility that if they're suffering, we're suffering. And it's so easy to just say we don't have a lot of access to what's happening in that underground church.
Yeah.
So what? They're still a part of the body of Christ that we need to be praying for, fasting for, sacrificing for. So if you're looking for something to do to help the church in China, yes, be aware of these great opportunities for adoption and reaching out to those who can take on that great responsibility just for these individual souls. But then also to know that we need to be praying and sacrificing for the church in China, because they're praying and sacrificing a lot for us as a part of the church as well.
There's something about China, man. It just like pulls on my heartstrings. It kills me to hear about this. So let's keep talking about it, you guys. And let's talk for a second what's going on in China with regard to the social credit. Mm. Here we are, religious persecution, the abandonment of children. We could go on. I mean, there's stuff, you guys, I can't even talk about on air. I know women and nuns who have been working for years underground, creating underground maternity homes to protect women who are being forced to abort. I mean, the things that they share are horrific. And I can't talk about it because I can't allow for these people to get in trouble in China for what they're doing. That's how bad it is. But the social credit system in China, by the end of 2020, they intend to have it fully implemented. The social credit system is basically looking, if you violate our laws, you're going to not be able to take a step in society as a normal, functioning, free human being. And we're seeing the reduction of human dignity on a day-to-day basis, where in some areas we've already seen, I was just looking at the numbers, it's baffling. Already, based on social credit, Father, 11 million people have been denied flights and 4 million people train transportation.
You know what this reads like to me is a society that's obsessed with efficiency.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, rather than a society set on fidelity and free choice, it's something that's set on efficiency. One of my favorite stories growing up, I read it when I was in eighth grade with my class, was The Giver. I don't know if you remember that story. There's a movie about it a few years ago.
They made it.
Yeah. And it's kind of dystopian story that's, you know, kind of meant for, you know, teenagers and young adults and whatnot, but tells the story of a society that's so set on efficiency that, you know, everybody has a role, you know, not necessarily when they're born, but when they're, you know, they go through their schooling and their education, and then when they're teenagers, they receive their role, and, you know, everybody sticks to their role, and that's why the society is what it is. Then you realize throughout the story that there's something that's missing, and it's love. Mm. And so they've given one person the role of receiving all the memories of love in the past, you know, all the great poetry and musical compositions and stories that speak of love. But he also is the one who receives all the memories of war and poverty and suffering, because that's something that really comes with love. You know, the risk of love is a risk of loss, you know, and suffering in the face of loss. And so at the climax of this story is this moment where, you know, the word love is used. Mm-hmm. They're like, that word's too imprecise.
They had a hard time handling it
because love started to find its way back into the society, and it was starting to tear apart their idolized efficiency. And there's this, you know, great conversation at the end of it, like, oh, if you only knew the raw possibility of love. You know, we're living as like shadows of what we were created to be, just faint whispers of what we were made to be, you know, because we've given up on love. So what's more important to us as a society, efficiency or fidelity? And, you know, when I read about this, you know, this big brother thing that's happening in China, that's what I hear. That's what I read, is they're trying to, you know, develop something that's, you know, that idolizes efficiency. And so they're able to go through, what does it look like, social media and different purchases and different actions, you know, good things. Sometimes, you know, do you volunteer a lot? Okay, great. You get social credit. And so they're creating a system based on how efficient can we make our citizens. And those are the ones that will be rewarded. And it doesn't, I don't know. Is it going to leave a lot of space for forgiveness and mercy and reformation for those who, you know, who fall and who fail?
Not when religion isn't allowed.
No, certainly not.
Not when you're forced to kill your children. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at it. Yeah, I mean, you're asking a perfect question. And this idea of efficiency that you're talking about, and bring it to even the United States society, we build up in our own minds that our full purpose and meaning is in what we do, what our career looks like, what that is, that too is this over-obsession with efficiency. How do you contribute to the society? For some reason, the stay-at-home mom is looked down upon as not contributing to society because she doesn't have some fancy title behind her name. Mm-hmm. Yet she's contributing to the development of the human person, which is the most important thing in society.
Yeah, like monastic communities, right? You know, I've even heard it within the church. Like, what good do monastic communities serve us? They should be out on the streets serving the poor.
Gosh.
I'm like, well, those who are out serving the streets on the poor can't do what they're doing without those monastic communities praying for us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one of the most beautiful images I've heard about, you know, especially the early years of a child's life, is that the mother begins, you know, to live somewhat of a monastic life because her life is centered so much on the home as the domestic church and this child, that, you know, the rest of the world, you know, she can't have as much concern about it because she's so focused on the life that's right in front of her, and helping to, you know, to receive life, to bear it, and then to nurture it.
Well, isn't that such a beautiful idea? And so many women become so lonely or bored or sometimes even depressed in those first years of motherhood. Yet that's opportunity where, wow, what powerful opportunity to offer up that isolation, to offer up that child, or maybe to offer up that additional time and take your child with you. Like, get comfortable getting uncomfortable, you know?
Right. Yeah, and not, you know, not to make light of the very real cases of postpartum depression.
Absolutely.
And something that is a real concern. But I'm convinced that if we can reestablish the beauty of these first couple years of motherhood as a place of almost monastic growth, and something that actually does a very real good for not just for the family but for the world around the family. Yeah. I think that's something that we need as a church to continue to lift up the vocation of mothers. You know, whenever a mother comes to me for counseling or confession, not going into anything that they might have to say, but one of the things, most important things that I feel I must do is just thank them for the vocation to motherhood that they've taken on, because it's this beautiful image of who the church is meant to be to the world, is mm-hmm. this mother, and that, not to put any pressure on mothers, but to say, look, you have this beautiful responsibility and vocation to image to the church, to your family, and to us. And so I thank you for your motherhood, even though it's not easy. And so it's a beautiful opportunity just to affirm mothers in their struggles as mothers, and that they have a beautiful opportunity to kind of live this monastic, focus on prayer and growth.
But you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that, because a dear friend of mine who's also an avid listener of Trending, I was talking to just a couple weeks ago, and she was sharing with me. I was very excited to hear. She was very inspired to what she was hearing on Trending this past summer when we were talking about, like, this idea of living a better lifestyle of, prayer, fasting, re-implementing, really. And I kept talking about a monastic lifestyle and how all of us, not just the monks, need to discipline our lives of the Benedictine attitude of ora et labora, right? Prayer at work and work at prayer. And how she actually, along with encouraging some of her friends, has gotten everyone to be on the same pace of having a monastic lifestyle prayer. And it actually has really helped her, because having those set prayer times, she said, yes, I fail throughout the day sometimes, but having really those set prayer times allows her to have a schedule to implement everything around the rest of her day. And whether it's actually making sure all my little itty bitty ones have their teeth brushed every day, mm-hmm. or making sure that certain things like food is actually prepped and that we're not last minute rushing through things. But when prayer is the center, the heart of the day, it gives purpose to everything else. And it was so cool to hear her talk about that.
Yeah, that's great. And to hear that, the reality in a family that, not everything's easy to do, of course, but how can we do these things with love? How can we do these little things with love? And so I always, point people that I'm counseling to, like back to, St. Therese of Lisieux, and, her great movement of love is, I can't do big, great things here in Carmel, but what I can do is I can do the little things here. I can do them with great love.
Yeah.
And so if you don't know St. Therese of Lisieux, she's this young girl. She was 15 years old when she entered into the convent as a Carmelite nun. And, she pretty much disappeared from the world at that point. But then we rediscovered her through her writings. She was asked to write about her early life and her time in Mount Carmel. And we get this beautiful image of, her nuns, her sisters in Mount Carmel would have said, oh, there's nothing remarkable about little Therese.
Yeah.
But then we find out this spiritual powerhouse of, doing little things with great love. And I love to see how families can live that out. Yeah. You know, mothers who are raising little children and, you know, teenagers, like, hey, you're being asked like no generation before to be impressive. And there's a lot of pressure on you. But what if you started, you know, looking at the little things that you've got to do and say, I want to do this out of love rather than out of, you know, I need to impress somebody.
And it always stood out to me. I remember there's one piece where she talks about the pain of reaching down to pick something up off of the floor after a sister she really didn't like that maybe was a little inconsiderate, but she offered it up and she did it with that great love. And I mean, it's such a small task, yet something so profound. And when we modify how we handle small things, it really impacts the habit of how we handle the bigger things that come less often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it helps us see the people that we're doing these things for as people we love.
Yeah.
You know, I'm washing the dishes. Yes, it's as simple as that, my friends. I'm washing the dishes and I don't like washing dishes, but if I do this knowing I'm doing it out of love rather than out of duty, then what an amazing act of love that can become. And the person that I'm doing it for is somebody that I will the good for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm doing this out of love for them. And they're a person. You know, and going back to what we're looking at in China and everything like that is how are we possibly going to build up a society that's not built out of, out of love, but out of fear and a desire to win social credit?
Yeah.
How is anything going to be done out of love when it's all going to be done out of, well, I hope to be able to function in this society. So I'm going to serve the poor so that I can get some social credit. I'm going to not commit crime so I can get, you know, keep my social credit. You know, it's a way of motivation for sure. But again, it's this idolization of efficiency.
God created us with great dignity. Mm. When he looked at us, he created us. He said we were very good. He said the creatures in the created world were good, but he said we human beings were very good. Mm. That's because we were like him. We have human dignity. And with human dignity, that means two things. We have intellect. We have the ability to come to know something, and we have free will. And so this is why Catholicism matters. This is why freedom matters and why we have to advocate it, whether here in the States or there in China, or even here in Ireland, we're going to talk about in a few minutes, because freedom, the ability to worship God, transforms and uplifts the human person as opposed to some of the craziness that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, we as a Catholic Church understand the human person, the good and the bad about it, like no one else.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of stuff that I receive in counseling and confession and everything like that, like I've got a sense of the human person that I never expected to have, the good and the bad, and I've seen what God has created, you know, the good that God has created and the way that sin destroys that. And, you know, the Catholic Church has an understanding that, of the human person that no other institution possibly could have.
Mm. Yeah. So profound. So I want to talk here in Ireland. We talked at the beginning of the show, if you were with us. By the way, that's Father Tim Grumbach. I'm Timmy Millington. You're listening to Trending. In Ireland, we saw earlier this summer, the first time people in the world voted to legalize abortion, to kill off their own children. Every other time it was a government to judicial system. Now the people have voted. And now what's happening is the doctors are being brought into meetings, nurses, other medical professionals, and they're finding out that they're going to have to participate in the killing of another human being. And we just saw dozens of doctors this past week march out of a meeting as looming on January 1st. They intend to have abortion legal in their country. And we're talking also about Southern Ireland. Northern Ireland is still illegal, praise God, but pressure is being put on them by the United Kingdom to change that. But here's the deal. Ireland, here are people who are objecting to abortion, yet their conscience rights. They're being forced to participate. There's no law regulating conscience, saying what you do and do not have to participate in. In fact, they're saying that every Catholic hospital has to perform abortions.
Yeah, because, you know, conscientious objection is for individuals, not institutions. So a Catholic hospital can't, you know, rely on its conscience and the teachings of the Catholic Church. Does that leave, you know, the doctors with the decision? Probably not. You know, it doesn't look like it based on this walkout during this conversation. And so in such an unfortunately post-Christian, post-Catholic society that Ireland has become, you know, what opportunity are they going to have for true, you know, conscientious objection, especially as institutions, as Catholic institutions. Apparently none.
Absolutely. And to see the fact that maternity hospitals are going to be forced to perform abortions. In fact, they plan for every general practitioner, general practice to be able to offer abortion. They're not just saying, hey, let's offer abortion in abortion clinics. They're going to be one of the few countries in the world that are offering unregulated abortions and basic general practices. And they plan to start doing this at the first of this coming year, and people are saying, we're not even ready for this yet. The expectation is this widespread access to abortion, because we need to be a part of the first world. We need to be a part of society. We need to make sure we're not oppressing women. We'll be right back on Trending.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Father Tim, you've been watching what's going on across the country, and you are now seeing the first teacher fired for not even using the wrong pronoun. What do you think about this? So this disaster in Virginia, talk about it.
Right. We're looking at a teacher who was fired for for misgendering a biologically female student by refusing to use male pronouns. And it looks like he was a French teacher.
Yes.
So interesting thing about that is, I imagine French, like so many of the other languages, actually uses different genders in a very different way that we use in English.
Every word has a gender.
Right.
Almost
right.
Every
yes.
word.
And the proper use of the word gender is, within language, is not necessarily for people. It's something that's developed socially over the time. But just to see that a teacher refusing to use that kind of language is losing his job because of this. It's something that I think we've been seeing in Canada, in recent times, but also now to see it here, it's in Virginia, here in the United States. It's a disturbing trend of, we're trying to figure out what it means to have an identity in the human person. And it's a misunderstanding of who the human person is and where we find our identity. And right. It's the issue that goes into how we minister to those with same-sex attraction. And now those who are experiencing gender dysphoria, transgenderism, whatever language it is that we want to use. But it's a frightening precedent
It makes us ask a question too, Father Tim, because how far do we go at a certain point? Because, and we asked when I was with Trent Horn and we were doing our show Hearts and Minds together, we asked, at what point do you just sign the marriage license, for example, if you work for the county clerk? Or at what point, what point? And I objected, you never do, right? I don't think signing the marriage license is ever okay. And that's one of the debates that Trent and I had. However, here we're talking about calling someone by the right pronoun. Mm-hmm. And I actually think this teacher did it right. Instead of ever referring to the biological male as male or female, he always used the person's name. Right. Now, actually, he used the new name that this person wanted to be called by. He just avoided using any type of male-female pronoun. So in actuality, I think that he showed the student a tremendous amount of respect by using the name they wanted to be called by, but wouldn't speak a lie by referring to that boy as a girl. Mm-hmm. And so I actually think he did a great job. He was originally put on some sort of probation a few months back in the fall, and now finally, actually, in a vote of 5-0, the West Point School Board voted to fire him. This is where we have to ask, I think that he did this right. When I look at it from this perspective, he spoke truth but still respected the student.
Yeah, and he didn't speak against this young person's wishes. He just not against the wishes, just not for the wishes. I did not want to refer to this young woman as a young man, and he said, I'll be happy to use the new name. I'm just not going to say something that's not right in front of me, and it's something that's not the truth. And so he wasn't trying to be offensive. He's trying not to offend.
Yeah. And that's a correction. It is actually a biological female.
Biological female, yes.
And there are moments where you have to be really careful here.
And his lawyer is saying, one of the rights that's not curtailed is to be free from being compelled to speak something that violates your conscience. And so we're talking about compelled speech here. And they don't seem to have a problem with compelling a certain type of speech. And that's something that's frightening, is that side of the movement is trying to compel teachers and others who are in the responsibility of teaching to use a certain kind of speech.
The language, it's not true. And that's what he's saying. Yeah. He's speaking a truth to that child. I mean, high school student, but to that child, saying, I will respect you, but I will tell you what is true and what is real. And even then, he's showing that respect by not using the pronouns of choice, not even the pronouns of reality, but a name. And I think that that was a great honor he showed. And please pray for this man, his family, I'm sure, and all those who are standing up for what is true, especially in a respectful way, and that we have the ability to do it in a respectful and honest and loving way. Even if we die on that sword, at least we did it with great love and with truth.
Yeah. One of the frightening things about this, though, too, is that there's not a distinction being made, not that I'm seeing, between those who use genuinely hateful language and those who mean to speak the truth.
Yes.
And that's one of the frightening things as someone who teaches the faith, that I can speak the truth as the church teaches it and to clarify language, but then that will still be not distinguished from language that is truly hateful, truly abusive, truly violent towards those who are experiencing same-sex attraction or transgenderism. Even Twitter has this to say, targeted harassment or expressing hate towards a person, group, or protected category is banned.
Yeah. So but, at least they have qualifications versus right now there's no qualification. There's no clear rule that this man broke.
Right, right. And so, like I'm saying, what I'm afraid of is that I'll teach the church's teachings developed over thousands of years that I believe wholly to be true. And that's why I will teach them. And I'll be put into the same group as those who use blatantly offensive and violent and abusive language towards those experiencing same-sex attraction or transgenderism. So it's a frightening thing that's not being distinguished even in Twitter's own policies.
Well, and I'm so grateful too that here in the state of California, for those who know, I'd spoken about it on the show, we were facing where language and literature, we were going to be punished for what language and literature, including the Bible's used if it spoke out against transgenderism, homosexuality. Luckily, praise be God, actually the author of that bill pulled it after traveling up and down the state advocating for this law that would have banned churches from having the Bibles or even some of the things we say on trending. And he said, I'm actually convinced otherwise. And it was a tremendous intercession of prayer and activism. But this is where we're at, and we need to be willing to do what we need to. Write the petitions, lobby our politicians, speak up for what is true and right so that we can continue to do so. That's Father Tim Grumbach. I'm Tim Ray Millington. We're going to be talking now about the sex abuse scandal. Very briefly, for those who don't know, just about a week and a half ago, or actually almost 2 weeks ago now, we didn't have trending last week, so I feel like there's so much we haven't talked about, but the Archdiocese of Houston was raided by the district attorney over the sex abuse scandal, specifically relating to a sex offender priest who they were trying to obtain information from. Now, we see that the Cardinal DiNardo, who's actually the head of the USCCB, and that is his diocese, was fully cooperative, but the diocese was actually raided, I think, for 12 hours documentation being pulled from the building.
Yeah, the Archdiocese actually prefer that the language of raided not be used. They even found the best photos I think they could, not the Archdiocese, but the media, to make it look like they had come into, storming into the Archdiocese and carrying these boxes out. But it was something done in cooperation with the Archdiocese. And yes, we can look at it and say, we wish it had been done a little more proactively than to have these government officials come in and kind of seemingly force their way into certain files. But while it may not have been raided, there's still the issue of, these files now belong to the federal government. Is that right? Yeah. And so they... instead of the situation being handled a little more quietly than it was, the language could be used of that the Archdiocese was raided by these federal officials.
And technically, it still was. But we're at the point where we're seeing parishes and dioceses where they're being forced to turn over information because this is what's come out. The most recent sex abuse scandal is finally we're seeing it's clear, and many people have known this, that unfortunately bishops have been covering up and moving around sex offenders within the church, not reporting or filing documentation. And so public officials are coming in saying we need to have access to this information, anything you have, because if there is cover up taking place, we need to eradicate it. And I really appreciated. In fact, I don't know much about him, but the district attorney, what I do know in his press conference, I really respected, where he's talking about how, you know, we have the Feast Day of St. Nicholas, which is now past coming up. And he said, you know, he was a great giver to children, and we need to pray for his intercession for the children of this country, of this diocese, of this church, of this sex offender, that we will stand up and be advocates for children through this.
Yeah, you and I have been talking about how important that these things come out to light, but that they come out in a healthy and healing way. Yeah. And so that's actually one of my concerns. And I mentioned this to you, was, you know, we can look at the way that God has interacted with his people before. You know, the readings over the last couple of weeks have been, you know, not just in preparation for Jesus to come as a baby, but for Jesus and his second coming in glory. And so a lot of the, you know, Jesus's own predictions in the Gospels have been used, and especially in the context of the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in the year 70 AD. We've gotten predictions, you know, prophecies from Jeremiah and Isaiah, looking towards the destruction of God's own home, you know, the place where he has chosen to dwell among his people. And we could look at that, you know, the world will look at that and say, look, your God has been defeated. And Isaiah and Jeremiah and Jesus are saying, no, God's the one that did this, because these structures are so corrupt and full of sin and death that they needed to be torn down. And so God needs to tear these things down in our lives in order to rebuild what was meant to be built there in the first place, and rebuild something new and more beautiful. Are we looking at something like that again? Is a serious question that we need to ask. Is, you know, Jesus in the book of Revelation was very, very serious at the very beginning, at the first three chapters, is, you know, look, I'm going to have to come and tear some things down because they should not be standing. Are we looking at that again in the church right now? It's a very serious question we need to ask. But my concern is Babylon. God let Babylon, God let Assyria come in, these different nations and these world superpowers come in and tear down Jerusalem, tear down Samaria, tear down his own dwelling places. But they went too far.
Mm-hmm. The people went into exile. I'll just emphasize, right, you know, we read about the exile of the Egyptian, of the Jews to the Egyptians, the Israelites to the Egyptians. Yeah. But in reality, the exile that was even more serious than that was when the Assyrians and Chaldeans came in.
Right, right. And yes, and so there's this destruction, and God lets his own temple be torn down. But then he punishes Assyria and he punishes Babylon because they took it too far. So he allowed them to come in and to work judgment into the lives of his people who needed something torn down. But they went too far. We need to pray for our government that is being allowed into these spaces in order to, you know, tear some things down in the church right now. We need to pray for them that they don't take it too far.
Yeah, that we don't go to the point where, oh, maybe we should have something like China, you know, Christianity is being overly persecuted. I completely hear where you're coming from. And so we have to pray for the people like this district attorney in Houston, who is going after wherever the trail leads him to find the information to prosecute the people who need to be prosecuted and protect the people who need to be protected and punish the people who have covered things up. We'll be right back on Trending with Father Tim Grumbach.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Welcome back. I'm in studio with Father Tim Grumbach. You can find us online at radiotrending.com. Always great to have Father Tim with us, so go check out all the episodes, including this one that will be available very shortly. We're talking about the sex abuse scandal and what we've seen. And one thing I do want to point out just briefly, because we're going to be coming up here talking about why women sleep better with dogs than humans in their beds. Much to be said there. But a study came out, praise God, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, who is a good friend and doing awesome work over at the Ruth Institute. She's really been a champion for the pro-marriage, pro-family movement. Has been a person who I have spoke side by side with out against. When we saw Prop 8 legalized, brought into law here, protecting one man, one woman marriage. And then we saw, as she really emphasized and woke up America to the fact that as we're talking about marriage between one man and one woman, we need to make sure that we're talking about children. And so she's been doing incredible work for a long time. Please follow her work. But when she saw everything coming out with the sex abuse scandal, she said, you know, we need to talk about this more from the children's perspective. And we need to look ultimately at the correlation between priests who are identifying as gay and those priests who are abusing young children. And the reality is that she and a number of people have gone into doing some very heavy research, and including Dr. Paul Solins, and they found a huge correlation here.
Yes, Father Paul Solans recognized that the John Jay report, which is a couple of reports that came out in the early 2000s after the initial abuse scandal had the awareness of it had hit in 2002, especially in Boston. And we in Los Angeles also took a particularly large hit because of that abuse scandal, and we continue to face that. And I remember studying in the seminary that, you know, in our marriage and human sexuality course, that was one of the main issues that we began to look at, was what was the cause of the abuse scandal, you know, or not the scandal itself, but what was the cause of the abuse itself. And it was very clear in the John Jay report, and, you know, if you wanted to get the right answer in class, it was to say it is not homosexuality and it is not celibacy. And
that are the causes.
That are the causes of sex abuse. And, you know, the information we were given, that seemed to make perfect sense. And but this new report by Father Paul Solans, PhD,
Father Doctor,
it's an excellent report, and it questions that conclusion about the role of homosexuality in the priesthood and the role that played with the abuse. You know, because just looking at the statistics, it's a little over 80% of the victims were males, and a large percentage of them were teenagers, I believe.
Yes, post 7 years old.
Yes.
Vast majority being in their teens.
Right, right. And so
emphasizing post-pubescent.
Right, right. And so what we're looking at there is, you know, in the majority, it's not necessarily pedophilia as pedophilia is defined technically.
Yeah.
But it's something that recognizes more so, you know, the kind of homosexual activity that, you know, for one, is any sexual activity is, you know, canceled out by the promise of celibacy. But then to recognize, he went through the report done by the Los Angeles Times around that same time, about 2002 or so.
So he took the research, LA Times, of the John Jay report. He also took the Pennsylvania grand jury report and other research that has been done in other dioceses as well, including what the USCCB reports every single year based on what they know of sex abuse cases in each diocese. So he took all of it together, and what he saw ultimately, that ultimately, yes, there was a decline in sexual assault within the church, but that correlates with a decline in sexual assault across all of society. It's not that, oh, the Catholic Church got better at regulating whether or not there was sexual assault. It's just that across the society, we became more aware and conscientious of this with mandated reporting and so forth. But what they did see is that, in fact, since 2002, when the original church sex abuse scandal came out, that, in fact, it's been the church hierarchy that has been very complacent in ignoring and kind of hiding it under the rug what's been going on. And with that, what they saw is that between the 1950s and the 1980s, in the priesthood, you saw basically, say, the general population of people who identify as same-sex attracted, you saw twice that number of actual priests being same-sex attracted in the priesthood. As of 1980, it was 8 times the number compared to the population. So basically, within the Catholic Church and the priesthood, we have more people who are identifying as same-sex attracted than we see in the general population.
That's right. It was looking at the general population being about 2%,
right,
and then about 16% within the priesthood. And, you know, one of the easiest conclusions to make in that is, you know, during that time, especially when it was a little bit more acceptable for men to come out as gay in society, that it was easier for them to just go into the priesthood so as to not be asked questions or whatnot. And so, you know, again, it must be stated that, you know, we're not saying that every priest who has, you know, inclinations towards same-sex attraction, they're going to be an abuser. That's not what we're saying. But he finds some very strong correlations, about 90%, right? Correlation that, you know, the numbers of those who are same-sex attracted within the priesthood, and, you know, is correlated to the amount of abuse that was happening in the church. It's a frightening statistic, but something that needs to be, that we need to be made aware of, so as to ask, you know, what is our formation of priests going to look like moving forward?
Right. And this was a hard study for you to swallow, because you were really taught the John Jay study, but what came out looking at the John Jay study and its relation of sex abuse scandal and homosexuality, basically there was actually no data there. It was just kind of, well, based on, it was like a secondary, like, I think this is a comment that I would add in there, but it's not anything that was a part of our research. And so what this study coming out of the Ruth Institute is saying is that it shows the chart, and the chart where the increase in the homosexuality difference from the 1950s to the 1980s and up, that's exactly when we see a major spike in sexual abuse of children who are in high school. So young, and especially, again, it's 8 out of 10 of those are young boys. So clearly that link between same-sex attraction in the church is very strong. And we really just wanted to make sure you guys have this information, because this is something that is covered up by mainstream media. And so if that's the only area you're following for, quote unquote, you know, what's going on in Houston or anywhere else in the country, we need to know the truth that when we digress in terms of sexual morality, unfortunately, without help, without the sacraments, without proper education, even having boundaries, just like if I'm alone with my fiance late at night at 11 o'clock, say sitting in a bedroom, that doesn't put myself in an area that avoids the near occasion of sin.
Right.
Same thing with our priests, right? Mm-hmm. And this is why we need to talk about this.
Yeah, that's why the human formation is considered one of the most important things in seminary formation right now. And ever since John Paul II, you know, kind of made that an emphasis of his, is of course, intellectual. That guy was an intellectual giant. Spiritual formation, no one prayed like John Paul II. You know, pastoral mm-hmm. formation, that man was everywhere. But what he found was most important right now these days was a human formation, an integral human formation, and helping young men understand, how do you relate to other people? What kind of places do you seek? Where do you seek intimacy in mm-hmm. healthy ways? And so the human formation is something that I can attest to has the quality of it has grown since I started mm-hmm. seminary through my years. I watched it get better and better, and I expect it to continue to get better and better. But it's something that, you're talking to priests who were, formed in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, that it was something sorely lacking. Mm-hmm. You know, talking to some priests who would say, yeah, they did not form us into how to live celibate lives. They just said, here you go, have at it. But now there's a lot more formation gone into, developing relationships in healthy and masculine ways.
Absolutely. I want to talk here now. So again, praying for the church, but let's talk now about, why is it? This study came out from the New Yorker, right? Where we're seeing that women are actually sleeping better. And when is this? They sleep better when they have a dog in their bed, not a human being. So this is actually from the New York Post. Great study that was done that we're seeing coming out of Kinesis College in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, and the first line is, let sleeping dogs lie. Would PETA be okay with that? I don't know if you saw that. They're trying to use more animal-friendly language.
Oh,
you know, do not say, kill two birds with one stone, but rather feed two birds with one scone. You know, I'm thinking, is there like rice in scones or something like that? It'll make birds burst like, oh my gosh, we never tried that, I swear.
But I did not know that. That is like, somehow you know someone who has.
Yeah. No, I've never done it myself, I swear.
He's witnessed it.
Yeah.
I can tell.
And another one of my favorite lines.
He's not denying it.
Let's move on from that. another one of the great lines from PETA was, do not say beat a dead horse, but feed a fed horse. And the question is like, what's more abusive, to beat a dead horse or to feed a fed horse? But apparently, so let sleeping dogs lie. This is really important for women to be able to sleep. And why is this? Why is it important?
I think it's interesting. The fact that, and it's not, women don't sleep better with people or cats. They sleep better with dogs. One, it's obvious because cats are a darn nuisance, right? I mean, who likes cats? I'm sorry to all my cat lovers. I'm actually very allergic. So not only do I not like them, but I'm allergic. It's awful. But you think about it. Cats are high maintenance. But people are complicated. They don't give unconditional love. Children are hard work. So of course, dogs who don't require anything from you per se, but feeding, and yes, they can be high maintenance too, but they're less complicated than human beings.
Look at what the researchers tell us though, is dog ownership and its associated responsibilities may cause individuals to adhere to a stricter routine. Keeping to a consistent sleep schedule may be beneficial to dog owners. These people don't have children, apparently.
They don't have children. So they're able to adhere to that strict routine. They're able to have their balance. They're able to have that unconditional love. People are just more complicated. And I think that as women, the pressure of sexuality on women is so high. If you think about it, vast majority of women now are sleeping in a bed with someone who's not their spouse. Mm-hmm. And I think that we also have a lot of women who have been sexually assaulted. And so the discomfort between that lack of commitment, that anxiety, women often end up engaging in sexual relations earlier because they want to feel loved. Well, a dog will make them feel loved without having to give up so much of who they are.
Right. Yeah. And we're wondering about the dignity of the human person again. We're preferring to have pets around us than our fellow human beings and the risk of love that comes with that.
Let's show people how great the human person is. Let's remind people that the church is speaking out for dignity, for truth, for authentic love. Let's not leave people turning to pets. That's the truth, because reality is our church is great and there's so much sacrifice to be had.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To book her to speak or learn more about her guest, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.